Hi everyone and welcome. My name is Zoe Lambert. I'm one of the editors for the Oxford Political Review. I'm also a third year politics and economics student at Balliol College, Oxford. I'm delighted and privileged to be joined today by Rashid Khalidi, who is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Middle Eastern Studies at Columbia University, as well as an editor for the Journal on Palestine Studies. He also acted as an advisor for the Palestinian delegation in the peace negotiations in Madrid and Washington in the early 90s, and is an expert generally on the Palestine issue. So there are a few people more qualified to comment on the situation in Palestine at the moment, and so it's an honor to hear from you today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we could talk all day about your fascinating life. I'd like to focus primarily today on your most recent book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance from 1917 to 2017. I thoroughly enjoyed the book and found it both thought-provoking and engaging, as well as being fairly accessible. So I'd really recommend it as essential reading for anyone, whether you have a background in international relations or history. I would just like to say that it's quite distinct from your other work, I found, having briefly read sections of your other work. So I wanted to ask, first of all, would you mind giving us a brief summary, an overview of the book, as well as what your motivations were for writing it and what you sought to achieve through writing it?
Let me start with the second part of the question. My motivations. My motivations were driven by the insistence of my son, who's a playwright, and a relative of mine, both of whom kept badgering me to write something that was accessible. You just mentioned that you found it accessible. Basically, my son said to me, enough already with academic books for other academics, enough, you know, footnotes and so forth. Write something that people can read who are not experts. Write something that people can read who are not PhDs in history, whatever. And they kept after me. And he additionally, my son, additionally said, I mean, there are stories you tell us and there are things that you've experienced, which a reader probably would not only benefit from hearing about, but which would lend immediacy and credibility to some of the arguments that you're making, that you would make or could make. And so I took these things to heart, and with the help of a very good editor and a very good agent and constant pressure from my son, who actually helped me to figure out a structure for this. I wrote a very different book than anything I'd ever written before. I've written, I think, 7 other books, all of them in the style that I learned as an undergraduate and then later at Oxford as a DPhil student, which is, you know, a certain kind of historical approach, a certain kind of detached third person, quote unquote, objectivity. And I departed from that in this book. It's got 45 pages of footnotes. It's heavily referenced. It's a history, but at the same time, I inserted myself, my family, families of friends, my wife's family, people I knew, stories I'd heard, things that I myself witnessed as a negotiator. You mentioned I was involved in the Madrid and Washington negotiations for 2.5 years, things I witnessed in Beirut and so forth. Things my father told me about his own experiences when he was younger, and then later when he worked for the United Nations. So I put all those things in the first person, which we as historians don't do normally. And so it's quite different from anything I've ever written. The structure of the book is very simple. I was trying to shatter a whole number of myths, starting with the title. This is not a war in Palestine between two peoples. It is a war on Palestine by an aggressive settler colonial movement, which has never operated alone. It has always operated with huge battalions of the greatest powers of the age, whether that was Great Britain at the height of its imperial power, or whether that was the United States and the Soviet Union at the beginning of the Cold War, whether that was Britain and France for a period, or whether that was in the last several decades, the United States. In other words, Israel has not been alone by itself, tiny little David facing the Arab Goliath. It has always, constantly, from the beginning, from the Balfour Declaration, which is where I date this from. That's why I dated 1917. The Zionist movement antedates, obviously, and Zionism antedate the Balfour Declaration, as does the rise of Palestinian consciousness. I've written a book about that. But the conflict in the form which we know it starts with the Balfour Declaration, starts with the Zionist movement finding an external patron, in this case, Great Britain. So that's the first part of the title, the War on Palestine. And the second part has to do with a fundamental misunderstanding. There are, in fact, two peoples involved in this struggle. There's now an Israeli people and there's now a Palestinian people. We wouldn't have said that 200 years ago. There was no such thing. There was no such thing as Palestinian national consciousness. There was no such thing as Zionism. There were Jewish attachments to the land of Israel. There was an attachment of the Palestinian Arabs to their country, but not in terms of modern nation state nationalism. The great, 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 great grandparents of nobody involved in the struggle today would have thought of themselves in those terms, nor would they have been involved in a conflict. There was no conflict before modern Zionism, none whatsoever. The idea that it is a conflict that goes back to time immemorial is an immense falsehood. This is a conflict derived from modern nationalism, modern colonialism. Before those things, without those things, no conflict. So I'm trying to argue that this settler colonial movement, which is at the same time a national movement, is involved in a struggle with the indigenous population, and that population resists. And I use what I consider to be an incontrovertible authority to make that argument, which is the father of the trend of Zionism, which has dominated Israeli politics for the last 50 years, Zev Jabotinsky, who talks about Zionism as a colonizing movement, talks about the inevitability of resistance by the indigenous population, and puts the thing in exactly the right frame, which is not Arab terrorism for anti-Semitic reasons against innocent Jews who mean no harm to anybody, but rather the natural, inevitable resistance of a native population, an indigenous population, being overwhelmed in its own country by a movement that is taking it over. And in Jabotinsky's words, transforming Palestine into the land of Israel. That's what Zionism is all about. And that's why you have resistance. So those are the bits of the title, the Hundred Years' War on Palestine, a history of settler colonialism and resistance. And that's why I start in 1917.
Thank you very much. Yeah, so core to this conflict then, as I think you've made quite clear, is this idea of these warring narratives. And that's mm-hmm. something that you've been guiding the conflict, justifying a lot of this. So this idea of a settler colonial movement, although I think I'm quite used to hearing about this, and as you say, this is something that is irrefutable because of the origins of Zionism. It's a narrative that you don't hear very often in the West, and from my impression, in the US especially. So I wanted to just touch on that a bit more. Obviously, that the conflict has a very distinct personality, if that makes sense, of being this conflict that's driven by these narratives. And while, of course, it does have a military dimension, which is incredibly significant, could you just give us a bit of an idea about the evolution of these narratives?
Right.
No longer, I don't think, would anyone who's trying to support the Israeli case stand up and say, yes, this is a colonial effort, because colonialism, for want of a better word, has gone out of fashion. A justification. So if you could just give us an idea of the evolution of those narratives.
Right. Well, the first point I think you aptly suggest is the first thing to understand is that this has always been a battle of narratives, one in which the Zionist movement won hands down for many generations. Mm. It established a narrative related to the Bible, the most familiar narrative on earth to certainly people in Europe and the United States. Related to the sufferings of the Jewish people, linked later on to the Holocaust, such that it became, it flooded the airwaves. It filled all of the narrative space. Edward Said has written quite eloquently, I think, about both the degree to which this was not just a military struggle, as you mentioned, but was a struggle over narratives, one which, as I've said, the Zionist movement won hands down. The other point to make is that it's not that surprising that they should have done so, not just because they had a compelling storyline rooted in the Bible, but also because all of the early leaders of the Zionist movement came from the countries where they were trying to proselytize. So you had Germans speaking to Germans. You had a British subject speaking to other British people. You had Americans speaking to Americans, Russians speaking to Russians. Now they were Zionists. They later became Israelis. But when Golda Meir came to the United States, she spoke in a Milwaukee accent, which is where she grew up. When an Israeli ambassador would go to the Soviet Union, he or she would speak his or her native language, which was Russian, even though they were an Israeli, and Hebrew had become their primary language, and so on and so forth. The Palestinians didn't have this advantage, obviously. We were talking about a largely European, certainly in the early years of Zionism, largely European movement based in Europe, speaking to Europeans and to Americans from a profound understanding of their societies, their politics, their languages, and their cultures. And so, of course, they had an enormous advantage at the outset, which the Palestinians simply did not have until very, very recently. In fact, there was just no way they could compete. They didn't have people who understood these societies the way that spokespersons for Zionism and later for Israel did. So that's, I think, a really, really important aspect of this. Now, the settler colonial bit is really quite interesting because up until World War II, I think we have to remember, under the League of Nations and in the post-World War I era, shaped by British and French colonialism, colonialism was still in good odor. It was still an acceptable thing. White settler colonialism had ethnically cleansed Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, and that was fine. What had happened to the indigenous populations was a footnote at best. And white settler colonialism continued to dominate Algeria, Kenya, Rhodesia, South Africa, and Palestine. And that was a good thing as far as the world was concerned. In fact, the League of Nations was invested through the mandate for Palestine in what was self-described as a settler colonial project. I'm not libeling early Zionists who called themselves settlers and colonialists. They themselves described themselves in those terms. One of the agencies that purchased much of the land in Palestine was the Jewish Colonization Agency. This is not some anti-Semitic slur. This is a self-description of people. And Jabotinsky says this in all of his writings. You know, yes, of course, we're the masters of the land. It belongs to us. We have this connection to the land of Israel, but we are European settlers and we're engaged in a colonial enterprise, which we can only succeed in with the support of an external power. He's very blunt about that. So I argue that that is and has always been the nature of Zionism. It's both a national project and in Palestine, a settler colonial project. And it's self-described, it was self-described as such. Until World War II, two things change. The British government changes its policy and curtails its commitments to Zionism, leading to a clash between Britain and the Zionist movement, A. And B, colonialism goes out of favor. Suddenly it's the era of decolonization. And so Zionists begin to describe themselves as anti-colonialist. This is, we freed ourselves from British colonialism is a trope that became embedded in Israeli historiography, which of course was true for about 2 years that they were fighting the British Empire, but they were the spoiled, favored child of British imperialism for two and a half decades until 1939. And that's whitewashed in much Israeli historiography. So things change obviously in World War II, but that doesn't change the actual nature of the movement in terms of how it behaves towards the indigenous population, in terms of how it has operated inside Israel between 1948 and the 1967 war, and how it's operated in the occupied territories ever since. It's impossible to look at what happens in the West Bank today without seeing it as settler colonialism. You literally can't do it. You can say they have a claim there. They say, well, this is our ancestral homeland. This is Judea. This is Samaria. But the methodology, the way in which they proceed is absolutely in line with everything the French did in Algeria or that was done in North America or South Africa or anywhere else where settler colonialism operated.
I think this comparison between Algeria and America and all of these other colonial efforts.
The one I haven't mentioned, of course, is Ireland. But yes, we'll get there.
I was in Palestine with someone who was Irish this summer, and apparently there's a lot of Palestinian support there because of the affinity between the Irish and the Palestinians. So the British...
Both people see it.
Yeah, but what's really distinct about the Israeli settler colony and the effort there that I think you touched on at the beginning is that the metropole that's sending out the settlers isn't the same as in the case of the other colonial efforts. You know, in Algeria, you have the French sending the French and setting up a French colony in, you know, in the United States, you have the British setting up a British colony. But as you said here, you know, it's a very mixed group of different people who are coming together who identify as Zionists, but also as Americans, as Zionists, but also as British Zionists, but also French. And I just want to explore that a little bit more. And that's quite a unique identity that this state has.
Right. No, you're absolutely right.
How does that shape and give them the flexibility to be able to settle there?
Well, it forces us to introduce some distinctions into the use of this term settler colonialism, because it is unique and distinct. In fact, I have to say, the more I think about it, the more I work on it, the more I read, the more I realize that every case of settler colonialism is unique and distinct. What happened in North America is different in Canada to what happened in the United States. What happened in New Zealand is different to what happened in Australia, and so on and so forth. Zionism is absolutely unique and absolutely distinct in that the Zionist project is not an extension of the population and the sovereignty of the mother country. So French settlers go to Algeria as French people, intending to turn Algeria French. And the French state and the settlers are one. This is true with British colonists in North America, or British colonists in the Caribbean, or British colonists, or the British plantations in Ulster and other parts of Ireland. The idea was to send people from the mother country as an extension of the mother country to create an extension of the mother country in another place, to turn Ireland English, to turn North America British, and so on and so forth. That's not the case with Zionism. Zionism is an independent project which shopped around for a patron, achieved success with Great Britain during World War I. The founder of the Zionist movement, Theodor Herzl, tried the German court, tried the Ottoman court, tried France as potential patrons for what was an independent national project. And they finally found support from Great Britain during the war, World War I. But it is completely distinct in not being an extension of the population or the sovereignty of the mother country. The idea was not to turn Palestine British. The idea was to turn Palestine into a Jewish state, or a Jewish national home, in the words of the Balfour Declaration. So it wasn't to be a British project. Britain was the overlord. Britain was under the mandate, had in effective sovereignty. But it was not intended that this become a part of England, as Ireland was intended from, you know, Henry II right up to 1922. So for 750 years, England and later Great Britain tried to turn Ireland into a part of its own sovereign territories. That was never the objective in Palestine. And in that, it's completely distinct from every other settler colonial project. And there's the national aspect, too. French people in Algeria did not want to be a separate sovereign entity. Algérie française, French Algeria, that was the idea. And that was the case with the Dutch in North America when they first arrived here. That was the case with the Dutch in South Africa when they first arrived there. They wanted to be part of the Dutch imperium. That wasn't the case for the Zionists at all. Britain and the Zionist movement had a transactional relationship. You will provide protection for us, and we will be an outpost for the British Empire, but we are an independent project. That was always the nature of the relationship. And it's the nature of the relationship today. Israel is an independent country. Israel is a nuclear superpower, but it is dependent on a patron, metropole, if you want, which is the United States and Western Europe. And it is a transactional relationship to this day, much more separate, as it were, from the metropole than was any settler colony. And it didn't require a unilateral declaration of independence or an American declaration of independence to be independent. It was always independent. So it's really important to recognize those distinctions when one uses the trope or the term settler colonialism.
Definitely. And just coming back to these narratives, I think one thing that you highlighted in the book and then also in further talks that I've listened to, that the narrative isn't just to justify the Jewish occupation of the Israeli state, but it also begins to, and from very, very early on, erase Palestinian agency and even the very existence of Palestinians. You know, in the Balfour Declaration, there's no mention of the Palestinians. It just talks about the non-Jewish inhabitants. I wanted to just quickly ask, in the Balfour Declaration, it says, just quoting, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Right. It's obviously very stark there that they're not specifically mentioning the Palestinians. But do you think at any point in the, from the beginning, from the Balfour Declaration, there was any effort whatsoever to protect the rights of the Palestinians? You know, we can see now that that's something that really hasn't been achieved or done very well. But do you think there was ever that intention, or was this just something to make the Jewish settlement more palatable to some of the opposition?
Well, I think you're right to focus on the wording of the Balfour Declaration, because the absence of any mention of Arab or Palestinian and the description of 94% of the population as the non-Jewish communities, by contrast with the Jewish people who are entitled to a national home, indicates a hierarchy. One group is a national group with national and political rights. One is not a group with national or political rights and has only civil and religious rights. That's what the Balfour Declaration, and that's what the mandate for Palestine was meant to achieve. It was meant to place one group in a position of superiority where it had a whole set of rights. And if you read the mandate for Palestine, half of the articles have to do with giving various rights, political representation, control of education, the right to immigrate, close settlement on the land, and so on and so forth, making no mention whatsoever of Palestinians or Arabs. The word Palestinian, the word Arab doesn't exist in the mandate for Palestine. It is a consciously discriminatory a document intended to establish rights for a tiny minority at the expense of the overwhelming majority. Now, does that change? Yes, it does. The Arabs, the Palestinians rise up in the late 30s against the British. World War II is looming. And in a pivot, which is, you know, typically cynical and opportunistic, the British cabinet decides to abandon many of its commitments to the Zionist movement, which it deduces has nowhere else to go. They're going to go to the Nazis? Of course not. And make some concessions to the Palestinians. So at that point, you could say in the white paper that's issued by the British government in the spring of 1939, yes, concessions were made to the Palestinians for the first time in the, I would argue, in the entirety of the mandate. But it was a cynical maneuver intended to secure support in the Arab world and in India, where Britain's behavior during the revolt had turned overwhelming majorities of the population against it, with a view to preparing the ground for World War II. They knew that they would be fighting a war with Italy and Germany. They knew that would be fought in the Middle East. They knew that the Indian army would need to be a major part of the British war effort. And they knew that they had totally alienated populations. The Secretary of State for India in cabinet discussion says, this is an Indian problem now, what we've done in Palestine. We have to correct this. They're all thinking of war. This is the summer of 1939. They know that war is on the doorstep. They've seen Hitler do what he's done. The Anschluss, the Sudetenland, the absorption of Czechoslovakia, war with Poland and with Britain and France is months away. They know this. So yes, they do curtail their commitments to Zionism. And yes, they make some very carefully hedged promises to the Arabs. But none of this ever comes to fruition, because by the end of World War II, Britain is no longer the dominant Middle Eastern power. The Soviets and the Americans are. And B, the promises to the Palestinians are hedged around with the condition that the Zionist movement has to approve. And of course, they'll never approve the kinds of conditions that are laid down in the white paper of 1939. And they get their way. They rebel against the British. They get Soviet and American support. The Americans and the Soviets push through the partition resolution in 1947, which gives the Zionist movement, which represents a third of the population, 55% of Palestine. And the rest, as they say, is history.
I wanted to come back to an idea that you broached at the beginning about, so you mentioned that when the Zionists approached the local governments or the national governments in their states, that they had the identity of those governments. And I wanted to just talk for a moment about the diasporas. So mm-hmm. I think the Israel lobby and the Zionist or the Jewish diaspora across the world has been highly influential in bringing about support from the great powers. But as you mentioned, increasingly Palestinians, because they've been displaced from their homeland, have formed a diaspora themselves, mm-hmm. and have become integrated, you know, you yourself, integrated into these states, and have increasingly learned the language and have become intellectuals and writers and worked for the media and things like that. How do you think that's shaped the conflict overall, and what prospect do you think that has in the future of shaping the conflict?
Well, I think it had a certain influence. I don't think that Britain's decisions in 1917 are shaped by the British Jewish community or by a lobby emanating from that community by any means. I'm strongly of the opinion that Britain's decision to ally itself with Zionism is a strategic decision based on considerations that go long before World War I, about the necessity to control Palestine as a buffer for the eastern frontier of Egypt, and to protect the Suez Canal, and to control the shortest land route between the Gulf and the Mediterranean. These are decisions that are taken between 1906 and 1914, and that's already set. And Weizmann then comes along and says, well, we are a potential ally in this. And the British seize on it. But the British support for Zionism is strategic and realpolitik. It has nothing to do with Zionism per se. Zionism offers itself as a convenient ally to achieve this strategic objective. That changes over time, obviously, and you now have a robust lobby supporting Israel in Britain and in other European countries. But I frankly think that in the early period, at least, it's very much overestimated in terms of its influence. Now, that changes over time. In the United States, it was not the major factor, I would argue, or in Britain. If you wanted to look for a factor, a cultural factor, I would call Christian Zionism much more important than any lobbying being done by American or British Jewish communities, certainly in the first decades of the 20th century. Now, that has changed over time, partly because, for example, in the United States, the Jewish community, which was severely discriminated against at the turn of the 20th century, and which is still a victim of anti-Semitism to this day, nevertheless became more and more influential over time. As people became more integrated and into society and assimilated, you still had people speaking Yiddish in the Lower East Side in the 1920s and 30s. You don't have people speaking Yiddish in the 2020s. So like other immigrant communities in the United States, that community assimilated and eventually, like others, became influential. The Irish became influential in one respect of politics, the Italians in another, and so on and so forth. After the civil rights movement, African-Americans finally began to have some political power. And so that did become a major factor eventually over time. The irony today is that I would argue that if you have an Israel lobby, it's primarily a Christian evangelical Southern conservative Republican lobby rather than a Northern urban Jewish dominated lobby. What one used to talk about in the days of, say, Harry Truman and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that the Democratic Party depended on a variety of ethnic communities, including Jews in urban areas, and that had some effect on politics. I mean, Truman was thinking of those things, and he said it. I mean, he's been quoted as saying, you know, I don't have Arabs who care about the future of this. I have Jewish constituents who do. That has changed because the Jewish community is now much more divided on Israel. On generational lines, with older people being still very, very committed to a traditional position of unthinking, absolute support for Israel, and younger people beginning much more to question in the Jewish community, to question things. Whereas support among evangelicals and in the southern states and in red states is the bedrock of support for Israel in Congress today. So these things have changed. The other thing to say is that if you look at this in terms of how influential the Jewish community is in American politics, you have to look at the period of the Holocaust to see how limited its influence was. There was absolutely no possibility of changing the racist, restrictive American immigration laws to allow people who could have escaped to come to the United States in the 1930s and right through the post-World War II era. Nor Roosevelt, nor Truman, who supposedly depended on, quote unquote, the Jewish vote, was able to do anything about that. American immigration laws stayed racist and restrictive right up until the 1960s. And hundreds of thousands of people perhaps died because they could not be allowed into the United States because of these laws. So this is a test, I think, an indication, I should say, of the lack of influence that the American Jewish community had in the 30s and the 40s. So again, I would argue that these are decisions that are made often mainly for strategic reasons. And then there are also often electoral reasons.
And we've discussed some of the roles of the Western powers, but I'd like to move now a little bit onto the role of some of the other Arab states, especially with this idea of pan-Arabism or a common identity, and also some common experiences, especially in Algeria, but also Egypt, of colonial domination by the Western powers. To what extent have these other Arab states been involved in the conflict in terms of supporting and also actually hindering the Palestinian efforts to gain their freedom?
Yeah, one of the things one notices from the very beginning of this story is the degree to which the issue of Zionism finds an echo all over the Arab world. I did research on newspapers published all over the Arab world before World War I and found literally hundreds of articles about Zionism, some objective or even positive, but most quite critical. And I've written about this in a couple of places. And that continues to 2022. The Arab Center in Doha, in Qatar, does annual surveys of public opinion in the Arab world, in I think 12 countries, a huge sample. And support for the Palestinians has really not changed from before World War I until the 21st century. That's say popular support. Now, why did that not translate into effective support? Sorry. Several reasons. First of all, most Arab countries were under foreign control until well after World War II. So there was very little that they could do. Egypt was nominally independent from 1922 on. It had a British garrison. It had a British ambassador who told the king what to do. The same is true with Iraq. The same is true with Jordan. Even after World War II, I would argue that you had a neo-colonial arrangement in many of these countries, such that they were not fully independent. If they were newly independent, they were still weak and feeble. And what they were able to do in support of the Palestinians was very limited. So you have popular support, which you can trace from before World War I through the interwar period to post-World War II period right up to now. But then you have the limitations of the various governments, either direct or indirect control by the European powers up through World War II. And then after that, a whole variety of issues that I think hindered any kind of effective Arab support for the Palestinians. One of them being, these are countries that are newly independent and have their own development problems, many of which are exacerbated by having Palestinian refugees dumped on them, in the cases of Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon in particular. And then you have rivalries between Arab governments, between Jordan and Egypt, between Saudi Arabia and Jordan, and so on and so forth. And finally, you have the fact that most Arab governments to this day have been undemocratic and have not been representative of the wishes of their people. So if Arab public opinion is pro-Palestinian, that does not necessarily tell you what the government of, say, Morocco or Jordan or Egypt or the United Arab Emirates is going to do. Those are not democratically run countries. Those are not countries in which the people decide. Those are countries in which the king of Morocco, the head of the UAE, the president of the UAE, and so on and so forth, is an, if not absolute ruler, an autocrat dominating the political system, Jordan, Egypt, and so on and so forth. So these are governments that are not representative of their people in any way as far as Palestine is concerned. In fact, they're much more concerned with currying favor with the United States or with Israel than they are with doing what their people want. And so this has been a constant problem for the Palestinians, dealing with regimes unrepresentative of their people or which are obstacles to what the Palestinians want or need, such that they have to appeal over the heads of governments to public opinion. And it's an unequal struggle. I mean, when you're dealing with Syrian public opinion in a jackboot dictatorship like that of the Esad family since 1970, you don't have very many advantages. Same is true with Egypt. How do you appeal over the heads of a military regime that has governed the country under different rulers since 1952, with one brief exception, when Morsi was elected president? It has been an enormous obstacle for the Palestinians. And it's one of the major reasons that Israel has been so successful. Divisions among Arab countries and the undemocratic nature of weak regimes lacking domestic legitimacy that rely on external support. So the United Arab Emirates, for example, today has a close alliance with Israel, partly out of its desire to have support against Iran, and so on and so forth.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I also want to make sure that in discussing the role of external powers, that we don't fall prey to the same mistake of removing all agency from the Palestinians. Obviously, mm-hmm. they have been largely victims of external powers' influence and just the scale of support from countries like the US, which means that resistance is almost futile. But I would just like to discuss the role of the Palestinian Authority. Mm-hmm. And you highlight right. in your book that they did make some crucial mistakes. I just want to discuss quickly, you know, were these mistakes, did they actually have any other options, or were they just backed against a wall? What role could they play in this entire situation?
I think one has to tread a very careful path in talking about this, because on the one hand, it is essential to recognize the heavy odds that the Palestinians are up against. I mean, in the interwar period, for example, period of the mandate, you're not just dealing with this well-funded Zionist movement that's well-motivated, that has people fleeing persecution in Europe, that, you know, as somebody put it, it was either immigration or extinction. You know, people had to leave Europe. And the only place open to them in many cases was Palestine. So they're up against this powerful, well-funded movement. I mean, the capital inflow to the Jewish economy of Palestine, they were separate economies. One of the points of Zionism was to create a separate economy. The capital inflow to that economy was higher than the GDP in some years in the 20s and the 30s. They were getting more money than was actually being produced by that economy. So you're dealing with this well-funded, well-motivated movement. And then you have the British Empire, which, you know, in moments of need, when the project is in trouble, sends 100,000 troops, the RAF. Experts in counterinsurgency, experts in torture, experts in building camps for detainees, and so on and so forth. The unlimited resources of the greatest empire on earth at that point were at the disposal of the Zionist movement and of British control of this country. Finally, you had the League of Nations, which endorsed and legitimized this whole business. Endorsed and legitimized what the British were doing, and endorsed and legitimized what the Zionists were doing. So to say the Palestinians were up against a pretty difficult trifecta there. And the same is true in different periods. On the other hand, you can see the failures of their leaderships over different periods, and you can also see some successes. You can see, for example, the incredible effectiveness of the revolt of 36-39 for a couple of years. You can see the effectiveness of the PLO in bringing the Palestine issue to world attention and in garnering support in the 70s, for example. The PLO achieved a status internationally, which the Palestinians had never achieved. They were constantly denied permission to narrate. Palestinians could not go before the Permanent Mandate Commission of the League of Nations. They were not allowed to, whereas the Jewish agency had diplomatic representation in Geneva. So they could, the British could talk and the Zionists could talk, the Palestinians could not. The same was true in terms of talking to the British government. Weizmann was received as a quasi-head of state. When Palestinian leaders went to London, they were told by the colonial secretary, we are meeting with you as a favor in our personal capacity. We don't recognize you, and we're not meeting you as ministers, as cabinet ministers. We're just doing you a favor because we don't recognize your standing. So there are those anomalies which people fail to recognize the importance of. And that continues until the PLO achieves a status with missions in more countries at one point than Israel had embassies. The First Intifada is another victory, forcing the Israelis to change their approach to the Palestinians. This is in the late 80s and the early 2000s. late 80s and early 1990s. On the other hand, I would say that Palestinian leadership has largely not been up to the level of the resistance that the Palestinian people themselves were able to put up to, nor in the Mandate period, nor I would argue after World War II, after the Nakba, after 1948, nor I would argue in the last several decades have the Palestinians had the leadership that they deserve. And this is partly due to limitations on the part of the social class that dominated Palestinian politics up until the Nakba, limitations in terms of the leaderships that dominated the PLO in the decades from the 60s onwards, and severe limitations today, where Palestinian politics are characterized by division between self-interested political groups, based in Ramallah, one based in Gaza, and where you have a collection of geriatrics and ossified old school politicians dominating Palestinian politics and creating a great deal of frustration among most Palestinians who don't feel that any of these people represent them or speak for them or have any idea of a successful strategy for liberation. So the Palestinians have enormous disadvantages. On the other hand, I think they can point to a number of successes in their history. And I think that those are things that perhaps are underestimated. I've written a book in which I talk about the failures of the Palestinian leadership, but I think it's important to also note that in spite of that leadership, the Palestinians have achieved some successes.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you talk about the resilience of the Palestinian people. That's something that when I was in Palestine this summer, I was in Al-Khalil, Hebron, which has obviously experienced extreme suffering. But
I think everybody should go there if you really want to understand the nature. Just spend a day in Hebron and it'll all become clear.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I think that's the moments of enlightenment for me, at least, that having read a lot about this, you know, in my course at university or just heard about it in the media, none of that captures the situation in Palestine at all. I was under the impression that this was in effect, the West Bank was a fairly independent Palestinian-led authority, and that actually Israel had very limited influence. But you drive into Hebron and you drive straight past a military checkpoint where they check everyone's passports, and the scale of the Israeli control over the entire city is just so noticeable.
And the entire West Bank.
Yeah,
it's exactly. A microcosm of the larger reality. Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, and it sort of creates a hostile environment. There are all of these different. I mean, I would appreciate if you could tell me more, because I obviously only spent about 2 weeks there. But there really is this feeling that they're creating a hostile environment, making life as difficult for the Palestinians as possible in order to try and provoke them to leave the country. But this incredible resilience that the people have, that they stay and they have this draw to their homeland. But yeah, if you could just tell me a bit more about the political situation there.
Yeah.
You know, the different zones within the West Bank and the situation.
Right. Well, I think you've put your finger on something, which is the obsession that every settler colonial project has with demography, decreasing the indigenous population and increasing the settler population. And that's been an obsession in particular of the dominant political trend in Zionism since the 1970s, which has produced most of Israel's prime ministers. And this was the trend that goes back to Zev Jabotinsky, the so-called revisionist Zionist trend, which gave birth to the Herut party, which gave birth to the Likud party. And it's now even more right-wing allies, which together believe in a greater land of Israel, which involves extending Israeli sovereignty over the entirety of former mandatory Palestine, limiting, decreasing, and if in any possible way, the Palestinian population, and increasing the Israeli population, not only inside Israel, but inside the occupied territories. They've walled off, fenced off Gaza. And so Gaza is removed from their considerations. And what they think about now is Judaizing, and that's a term that they use, Jerusalem and the West Bank, doing everything possible to make life impossible for the Palestinians and adding every possible incentive for settlement of either of Jews in the occupied territories. And that's been a drive of Zionism since the beginning. Herzl talked about spiriting the penniless Arab population across the frontiers in his diaries. That's 120 odd years ago. And that hasn't changed one bit ever since, that whether they spirit them across or whether they carry out selected massacres to force them, or whether they bombard them. This is a 1948 war, where there were massacres in some areas, where there were attacks on civilian neighborhoods with mortars and artillery and so forth, to decrease the Arab population and make space for Jewish immigrants. Or later on, the settlement of Galilee in the 50s and 60s and so on and so forth. Now that's operating in the occupied territories, in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem. And that's been that demographic struggle goes right back to the beginning. And so it's a struggle over land, and it's a struggle for demography. This is one of the great victories of the Palestinians. The majority of Palestinians who lived in what became Israel by the time of the 1949 armistice were expelled, driven from their homes, forced to flee, fled in terror, whatever. And Israel then occupied the West Bank in 1967, Gaza Strip, and other areas in Egypt and Syria. And expelled another several hundred thousand people. In spite of that, the Palestinian population in former Mandatory Palestine is equal to or slightly greater than the Jewish population. So that's an indication of the steadfastness of the Palestinians in the face of this constant harassment, this constant attempt to force them to leave. I mean, I have relatives whose Jerusalem residency has been revoked because they haven't lived in Jerusalem the requisite number of years over a certain number of years. No Israeli Jewish citizen is going to have their residency anywhere revoked, no matter what. They can live in New York for the entirety of their lives and they go back and they have all the rights. Whereas Palestinians whose ancestors lived in Jerusalem for 1,000 years or more, who violate these residency laws, are stripped of their Jerusalem residency. So this is part of an ongoing, you can call it an ongoing Nakba, an attempt to reduce demographically the Palestinian presence in Palestine, in all parts of Palestine. It operates inside Israel with racist laws about marriage. You can't marry somebody from the West Bank and get them to live with you in Israel if you're a Palestinian citizen of the State of Israel, and so on and so forth. All of this aimed at decreasing the number of Arabs and increasing the number of Jews. This is the nature of settler colonialism. This is one reason it has to be talked about. It's clothed, of course, in terms of a wonderful rhetorical flourish as, you know, the return of people to their ancestral homeland. This is the only refuge for persecuted Jews the world over, and so on and so forth. So what's talked about is the refugee or the persecuted status of people who may be arriving. What's not talked about is what is then done to the indigenous population to make space for them. That part is obscured in this wonderful narrative of Israel as a refuge. I mean, it's true, but the other part is also true.
Yeah, I think that narrative is just so potent. But I think you mentioned in a lecture in SOAS, I believe, about how in the academia that pro-Zionist narratives are increasingly rare, that actually you don't have many papers coming out with that Zionist narrative. But that remains highly prevalent within the public discord in policymaking and in the media. Do you think there's any prospect of the media and the public discourse kind of catching up to the academia in any way, or are those just two completely separate zones? And if so, what would the implications of that be?
You know, I actually think that academia does have an impact. You mentioned at the beginning that I'm the co-editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. Since the beginning of 2021, the Journal of Palestine Studies has had 327,000 full-text downloads of articles and essays. A third of a million full-text downloads of articles from the Journal of Palestine Studies since January 2021. That has to have an impact on students, on academics, and so on and so forth. There's no question. However, I would say that social media and an increasing worldliness, if I can use that term, of younger people, is having an even bigger effect than anything that's happening in academia. For young people going to universities, I think that this may have some impact, academia, the changes in academia. But I think that the fact that people are not restricted in the United States to three television networks and two news agencies and a few major newspapers and Newsweek and Time, which was the case for every generation before the 21st century, means that they have an unlimited variety of sources of information. Nobody in my classes reads the New York Times as their main source of information or watches CNN or Fox or any of those networks. They have multiple sources of information. And that means that the lock that the Zionist narrative had on the mainstream media is irrelevant for anybody under 20 or 30 or 35 or 40, whatever the age is. Everybody older than that is still believes all this nonsense about, you know, tiny little beleaguered Israel and the Arabs want to wipe Israel out, and so on and so forth, making the desert bloom, land for people, and so on and so forth. Whereas most people under whatever the age is, 30 or so, have access to enough sources of information that's claptrap to them. They can see that Israel is this giant power in the region. They can see the oppression of the Palestinians. Even if they're sympathetic to some aspects of Zionism, they're seeing aspects of reality that their parents and grandparents could not have access to. So that is changing things. Now, does that change politics? Not yet. It's changed it to a limited extent, at least, only. In the United States, there never was more than one or two elected representatives who dared to say anything that countered the mainstream pro-Israel narrative, from Woodrow Wilson until the 21st century. That's increasingly, how should I put it? That is beginning to change. You now have two dozen members of the House of Representatives and several senators who, in spite of constant attempts to unseat them, constant attacks on them, are still making points in support of Palestinian rights. Betty McCollum brought a bill before Congress, the last session of Congress, and she's brought it the previous session, the last session. I'm sure she'll bring it up in January 2023. To prevent U.S. military aid being used to harm children. It's a completely, should be an unexceptionable bill. And the Israel lobby is dead set against, we don't harm children. You shouldn't put any limits on aid to Israel and so on and so forth. The point is not that that bill is going to pass. The point is nobody would have dared say that 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. And you have dozens of representatives in the House, congresspeople in the House of Representatives, who brought this bill up and argue for it. And will continue to do so, all of them having been reelected in this cycle, in spite of millions of dollars being thrown into primary campaigns to drive them out and replace them with pro-Israel Democrats. Now, this is true in the Democratic Party, and this is new. Does it represent a change will it change American policy? No, it will not, not in the short run. But over time, the base of the Democratic Party is changing in terms of attitudes towards Palestine and Israel, and that may at some stage begin to have an impact on policy. It doesn't now. You have a octogenarian leadership, or at least a very aged leadership of the party, which is in lockstep with Israel. President Biden, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, the Vice President, Kamala Harris, Chuck Schumer, the majority leader in the Senate. Every single one of them is a very devoted, committed supporter of Israel. And that's the leadership of the Democratic Party, by and large. But the grassroots and an increasing number of representatives have a different view of these things. And that's new. When and if that'll have an impact on policy, I can't say.
Thank you very much. We could talk about this all day, but I just want to finish up by asking a slightly more personal question. But for us, as assuming a predominantly student audience, what role can we now play and what should we do to try and support the Palestinian efforts?
Well, I hate that kind of question, because I'm from a generation that, you know, has pretty much failed to change. I mean, maybe we've done something to change narratives, but in terms of our impact, those of us who live like me in the United States or in Europe, to impact on impact policy. And so I don't think that I'm necessarily the person to give that advice. I think that a lot of what younger people are doing in universities, at least in the United States, has been very effective. And it's even begun to ruffle the feathers of media and politician and media of the mainstream corporate media and of the politicians who realize that their sons and nephews and daughters and nieces see things completely differently than they do in many cases. And that's a really good thing. So whether it's in this country, Students for Justice in Palestine or Jewish Voice for Peace or campaigns for divestment, I think the importance of those is it raises issues that the Zionist movement would prefer not to have anybody talk about. Okay, their objective is silence. We don't want a discussion because they don't have very many strong arguments when push comes to shove about what's actually happening in Palestine. And when you kill X number of children and women in Gaza, it's pretty hard to justify it on the basis of whatever arguments are made about rockets being fired or terrorism or whatever it may be. There's an argument to me, but it's harder and harder to justify it. And they don't. Therefore, their main effort is to silence these voices by spurious and in my view, scurrilous charges of anti-Semitism. I mean, there is a powerful anti-Semitic current in American society. It's mainly on the right. And there are some people in the Muslim community. There are some people among other minority communities who are also anti-Semitic. But the campaign for Palestinian rights is primarily anti-Semitic is absurd. It's a complete falsehood. And it's an attempt to silence people because that's a terribly heavy accusation that you're a Jew hater. And it's the only weapon left in their arsenal almost because they can't controvert the arguments about Palestinian rights. The Palestinians are being denied the right to self-determination. The Palestinians are being denied all kinds of other rights, whether they're citizens of Israel, whether they're expellees and refugees, or whether they're living under military occupation for 55 years. You cannot argue in favor of those things. Yes, they have to stay expelled. Yes, they have to have second-class citizenship in Israel. Yes, they have to live under military occupation for a fourth generation. That is their fate because they're, I mean, what are you going to say? How do you argue in favor of those things? So instead you say, anybody who argues in favor of Palestinian rights is an anti-Semite. End of discussion. They're out beyond the pale. You can't talk to them. I think fighting that effort, which is powerful in England as well, powerful in Britain as well, very powerful in France and Germany and the Netherlands, many other countries, is a worthy battle, both in terms of focusing on real anti-Semitism, which is a scourge, and in freeing the effort for Palestinian rights from this scurrilous and spurious charge. You know, to argue for the rights of a people that's oppressed doesn't mean that you're against the Jewish people or Jews. It means you're against a specific form of settler colonialism, which in fact, many people in the Jewish community themselves are against. In fact, on American campuses, I would argue that as much of the support for Palestinian rights comes from younger people from the Jewish community as it comes from any other group. So it's completely spurious. Yes, there is anti-Semitism everywhere. Yes, some of it has infected some of these communities, African-Americans, Muslim Americans, some of the people associated with campaigns for Palestinian rights, but that's not where lethal anti-Semitism resides in the movement for Palestinian rights. That's a canard. And fighting that is, I think, something young people can do. It's a hard battle, heaven knows, because the other side is lawyered up to the gills. They have tons of money. They cooperate with the Israeli government, which coordinates these campaigns all across Europe and the United States. You see exactly the same words used in Germany and in the United States and in Israel and in Britain and so on. These are coordinated campaigns. So it's not an easy row to hoe, as they say. But, basically the charge is false. And basically the opposition to Palestinian rights is support for oppression. And how can you support oppression? And I think younger people are more open to that because they don't believe the false narratives that their parents and grandparents imbibed back in the day.
Yeah, I think that point about social media is especially relevant. My 14-year-old sister's has friends who will post things on social media and they'll discuss this. And I think that's an incredible change.
Even from your generation to people younger, it's remarkable.
Oh, yeah.
And from people, my graduate students to my undergraduates, there's a change. I mean, it can be used for all kinds of evil purposes too, heaven knows. I mean, the way that social media can be manipulated, it can be toxic. But by and large, I think it's opened up a lot of people to a lot of realities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, we don't have much time for anything else. So unless you have anything that you want to add to that, I'm happy to let you go.
Well, thank you very much for doing this.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Bye. Take care. Bye-bye now.